Hello again, and welcome to another episode of the Stuart Crazy Podcast. As always, I am your host, Rob Nelson. Today on the podcast, we are going to delve deep into the history of all things libraries, ancient, modern, foreign, and domestic. In the first segment of the podcast, we are going to be joined by the Stuart Museum Director of Interpretation, Kay Sanova, and we're going to talk about the history of some libraries, past and present. And then later in the podcast, we are going to shift gears and talk with Sean Klee, who is the Adult and Technical Services Librarian for the Grand Island Public Library here in town. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And we are back with more of the Stuart Crazy Podcast. I am joined today by the ever entertaining, ever knowledgeable Kay Sanova, the Director of Interpretation here at Stuart Museum.
My title keeps getting longer every time.
Yeah, well, I think we have a pretty good time when we talk about the subjects that we delve into.
Yeah, I think we're both interested in the same topics a lot.
Yeah, and today is no different because we are going to be talking about the subject of libraries and their important history to local communities stretching all the way back in human history.
Correct.
So let's talk about that, just for instance. How long have libraries been around, and what sorts of forms have they taken at different times in our past?
You know, the famous one that everybody talks about is the Library of Alexandria and all that mythology surrounding that. But I found that there was the 7th century BC Ashurbanipal in Nineveh. It's an Assyrian library, and that was considered to be the oldest library. And there were probably others that predated that they just didn't document as well. But there are people who cared about things and collected knowledge into spaces throughout time.
Yeah, and we're in this instance, Ashurbanipal, we're talking about clay tablets that have been, archaeologists determined that they were shelved. A lot of the larger tablets were shelved, and they were actually put in topical order. So there is...
Yay, organization!
Yeah, so there is, even at that early stage, human organization by topic of people collecting and organizing the knowledge of humans.
Makes it easier to find.
Yeah, exactly. But it's just that connection to these ancient peoples to even today of, the more things change, the more they're...
Yeah, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, because humans have always been human, I guess, is the moral of that story.
Well, there are people who like organization, and there are people who don't care.
Well, there you go. And well, that's as we were saying, that's a fight that we'll continue to fight.
Forever.
Mm-hmm. But in the more modern sense, there have been several claims to fame for the first libraries in the United States, as you and I both found.
Yes.
What was the one that you found?
Well, the Darby Free Library in Darby, Pennsylvania, established in 1743, is one of the ones that I found. But the first... tax-supported one, and I didn't write down the year of that, was the Peterborough, New Hampshire Town Library.
Yeah, that was established in 1833 by a vote of that town. But, there are several other ones that even stretch back further than that. Like, the Franklin Public Library in Franklin, Massachusetts was America's first lending library that it was established in 1778. And they go even further back than that. The Library Company of Philadelphia, founded in 1731, which was the first American subscription library.
A subscription library. I didn't look into that.
Essentially, it meant that it allowed members to borrow books, but you had to be
a member,
and you would pay a fee to be a part of the club. So it wasn't the free, sort of.
Yeah, so you couldn't, the free lending libraries that we're used to today.
Exactly, and... there's been, as we're saying, a lot of different forms that these have taken that are sort of different. But as we said, there's been some sort of library that goes back.
They're all variations on a theme.
Yeah. But still, every small town's going to want their claim to fame and say, we're the first one in this great country of ours.
Yeah. I suppose if you keep digging, you could find that, go back to some of the earliest settlements, that there's some type of collected knowledge someplace on this continent, but throughout Europe and Asia and all that, there's pr- probably going to be thousands of libraries.
Yeah, and like they take different forms than just those traditional styles as well, because, you know, as we were talking about before the podcast, there's been bookmobiles, there's been the little free libraries.
Yes.
You were saying during World War One that there was an effort to provide soldiers with books.
That looks to be like a really fascinating article. Nebraska History wrote that in one of their regular publications, and I just scanned it briefly, but I think that's something I want to go take a closer look at.
Yeah, the American Library Association during that period of World War One created the Library War Service to respond to soldiers' requests that they wanted books for just for entertainment at the front lines, because you're talking about a period where, you know, there's no radio, there's no television, there's no anything really. So,
and lots of boredom.
And lots of time.
Yes.
What's that saying? War is vast stretches of time of boredom punctuated by moments of sheer terror or something like that.
Well, yes. And there's all kinds of things that happen throughout life that it's hurry up and wait. And it's one of the reasons that no matter what, there's always a book in my vehicle so that I can have, even if I'm at waiting for a train to go across the tracks, I will take those minutes to read a few pages in my book.
Yeah. So the Library War Service that was created during this era, actually through soliciting donations from people, they actually managed to raise somewhere between 7 and 10 million books and magazines. And they established 36 libraries in different camps in the United States and Europe to provide these soldiers with entertainment.
And that's a pretty awesome thing to be able to have that. And I think it was well utilized.
In the more modern sense, I think, you know, you and I were both kind of surprised to find out about the recent history of little free libraries, which is kind of this new phenomenon that's been taking shape in the last 10, 15 years or so.
Yeah, 2009.
Yeah.
I kind of thought it'd been around, you know, because there's some around here in Grand Island as well.
Yeah, Todd Bowl of Hudson, Wisconsin was actually the first one to come up with this idea, and that's who this concept is attributed to. And he was essentially inspired by the gift sharing networks of earlier ages. He was inspired by Andrew Carnegie, who had a mission mm-hmm. to build, you know, over 2,000 libraries in Europe and the United States. And this kind of just took off in the within 2 years. He had 400 little free libraries, and that number took off to even 4,000 by the next year in 2012.
Well, and now it's a global phenomenon. It's everywhere. The page that I looked at showed pictures of one in a train station in Japan. Yeah. But if you're interested in that, they have a website, littlefreelibrary.org. So I encourage people to look, take a look at that and read more about the history of that.
Absolutely. And the mission that's on that website says, our mission is to be a catalyst for building community, inspiring readers, and expanding book access for all through a global network of volunteer-led little free libraries. And for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about here, because I was kind of new to this topic myself, anytime you might be driving through a local neighborhood and you just see, you know, maybe a weird-looking mailbox that looks like it has books in it, it might be you know, it might look like a one-room schoolhouse. It might look like a telephone booth from England, or, you know, just something kind of a little bit weird.
They make them all. The very first one that was built by Mr. Ball was actually in the shape of a little schoolhouse.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a tribute to his mom. So.
So there you go.
Yeah. They're all kinds of shapes. They've recycled old phone booths. They've done all kinds of different things, a way to house these books.
And the library system that has evolved in Grand Island has taken on a lot of these, you know, concepts as well. We're part of that unique story. And since this is a Grand Island, Nebraska history podcast, why don't we talk more about the libraries of Grand Island and Hall County specifically?
And I like to go look at the newspapers, and with the digitized newspapers, it makes it so much easier to look things up. So I actually found the publication of the original ordinance for the establishment of the library in Grand Island.
Oh,
it was in the Anti-Monopolist, which is probably a newspaper, local newspaper that's not looked at very often, but there's digitized versions. It appeared on the Wednesday, 22nd August, 1883, on page one, and it was ordinance number 66 for the establishment and maintenance of a public library and reading room. And it's rather lengthy and would exceed the time we have for our podcast to talk about. But nothing appears in the newspapers again until the 29th of August, 1884, at least not that I was able to find. But it's Books Wanted, an advertisement. The Grand Island Public Library Association has sent out an order for books and very soon will be ready for the visits of readers. They have engaged rooms over the First National Bank. It is probable that various people have books on hand that they would gladly donate to the association. If so, they will be received with thanks. Leave them with J.P. Kernahan, Mrs. O.A. Abbott, or H.O. Brown. The design of the association is to establish a free public library. Our citizens respond without doubt.
Well, I did some digging myself, and I found a little bit more just to kind of dovetail with that nicely.
I like how we both find different things.
So you mentioned the First National Bank. That was actually the first location of the Grand Island Library. It was in the second floor office of a Grand Island attorney named H.E. Clifford. It then moved to the second floor of the Grand Island City Hall in 1890, before ultimately in 1907, the construction of an actual building that was a Carnegie Library opened and then would house the selection of books.
Yes.
I also found, if you're interested, a book bill from the first books that were purchased for the first library in 1884. If you care to hear about them.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's kind of neat to hear about some of the books because I would want to make sure that I get reproduction copies of these to maybe put in some of the houses in Railroad Town.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're, you know, Railroad Town is an 1890s living history community. And as such, they would have had probably many of these books on hand had they lived during that time.
And actually, if you want to be official, Grand Island or Railroad Town does have its own library. It's in the Telephone Exchange Building.
Oh, yeah, that is correct.
Yes, we do have a handful of books there that we can loan out to the people who work in Railroad Town.
And it looks similar to those kind of those ones we were talking about.
Yeah, it's just a couple stacks of books in there that the telephone operator will check out to people.
So in this, I found in the City Council Board rules and regulations for the library's operation. They include this book bill, but also a few rules, such as the library was to only lend one book to each patron, and 5 cents per day for overdue books was a rule, and they also prohibited the perusal of books by patrons. You kind of have to just
know your book
and leave, I guess. But the first books of fiction that were included in this, you know, original charter of books were Ben-Hur, Little Women, Five Little Peppers and How They Grow, When a Man's Single, We Girls, The Second Wife, and Modern Prophets. And among the nonfiction works, there were a handful of different scientific readings, such as The Science of Politics, The Responsibility of Mental Disease, Modern Physics, The Conservation of Energy, Animal Mechanism and Diseases of Memory, and all these books were published sometime in the early 1880s and had an average cost of $1.50 each.
And that's you know, I know that some of the fiction works I can actually get reproductions of, and that's really awesome.
Yeah, that would be fantastic and really tie in that story.
Yeah,
really nicely,
as a matter of fact, it was the Five Little Peppers. We have had a reproduction of that for sale in the Mercantile from time to time.
So there you go.
Yeah.
You're more connected than you
could
know.
Connect to Grand Island history by getting a reproduction copy of some of those books.
Well, I know that we mentioned briefly the opening of the Carnegie Library in Grand Island in the early 1900s. How did that come about? What is a Carnegie Library?
Andrew Carnegie was a Scotsman and became an extremely wealthy Scotsman, and he wanted to provide libraries, you know, to get rid of some of his money in the U.S. and in Europe too, I believe.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to build all these libraries, and Grand Island luckily was one of the ones that got pegged for one of the Carnegie Libraries.
Yeah, the first one opened in 1883 in his hometown in Scotland, which was Dunfermline, Scotland. And Let There Be Light is actually the motto that's carved into the building's sandstone entrance, which is, I think, really cool. But I know in the late 1890s, early 1900s, that towns began to kind of, the word was out because everyone knew who Andrew Carnegie was. He had sold his Carnegie Steel Company to J.P. Morgan for some ungodly number, that was something in the neighborhood of $400 million. But at the time, that meant essentially a kajillion dollars. Yeah, it was an unfathomable amount of
like
money.
Billions today or something, equivalent-wise.
Maybe the equivalent in billions today. Yeah. And he just got the philanthropic itch and started opening libraries for people so they could have access to education. And these towns started applying for funds for libraries, and Grand Island was one of these communities.
Yeah, evidently all of the criteria was met, and we were given a specific amount to construct the library. And it was a really unique time because we got to have a presidential visit as part of it.
Yeah, and I actually just found this, that you mentioned the requirements. Carnegie required each town that applied to contribute 10% of its annual funding to its library, supply its own building site, and provide free service to the public at that library.
Well, and it's interesting because some of that is kind of covered in the original ordinance about the funding and everything. So some of that was kind of already established.
Yeah, so we were a good candidate even from the get-go. Mm-hmm. But as you were saying, our opening came with a lot of pomp and circumstance. Mm-hmm. As soon as it was finally
the actual turning of the soil, the breaking of the ground ceremony, elicited a visit by Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, he was on a nationwide tour that spanned something like 14,000 miles, went through 20 plus states, and on one of his journeys, he happened to be coming through Grand Island, and they asked him to turn over the soil and make the first dig for the construction of the new Carnegie Library that was going to be built here in 1903.
Yeah, he turned it into quite a visit because he kind of wanted to do something active. So they set up a horse ride that was from the original Washington Township Hall, which was originally placed on the corner of Locust and Stolly, where Godfather's Pizza is now. And they rode horses all the way out to the Taylor Ranch on the road going to Caro and then back into town. And he made a number of stops along the way. But he had lunch out at the Taylor House and then came back into Grand Island. And I think that it was the next day when they had the groundbreaking ceremony.
Yeah, and I can just imagine how amazing that, or just the excitement that must have been present in the community during that time, because reading the transcripts of his visit, just everybody is involved. Like, the mayor is there, the mm-hmm. abbots are there, Leshinsky, the noted photographer of many of the photos of the Grand Island collection, he's the one taking photos, yep. and there's 900 children on the sides of the street who are greeting him, according to reports.
The photographs that show him giving the speech at the site and all of that was just, there's just so many people packed like sardines in the area.
Yeah, and just to be a fly on the wall would have really been something.
Oh, some of the conversations. Oh, it would have been so interesting to hear some of those.
He actually gave a speech at the high school grounds right after the ceremony for the library, and there is an excerpt of that speech that I found where he said, "This morning I have turned the sod in preparation for the building of your new library. It is certainly a commendable enterprise. As I came here, I passed through rows of school children. Now I am proud as an American of what Nebraska has done with its products of farm and range. I am proud of your material development, but above all, what really counts in any state and in any time is the character of the men and women whom that state produces. That is the essential thing. And the school, the church, and all that instructs for the moral and intellectual improvement. Those are the agents that count more than all else in the development of citizenship. Of these things, as Americans, we have a right to be satisfied."
Wow.
So those are pretty nice things to say.
Very nice things to say. Very nice to say. yeah, it had to have been a very heady period of time when he was visiting in town, because he came in on the train and, you know, because that was part of the tour. That was the transportation mode of the time. So,
yeah,
there was a lot of excitement and a lot of things that happened over the period of time.
And that would continue because that was just the groundbreaking ceremony. It had not yet been built.
No, no.
It didn't open until 1907, some 4 years later. But even then, there was another kind of pomp and circumstance event, and William Jennings Bryan spoke at the grand opening of the event.
Yes, I forgot about that.
Yeah, and like the abbots were there, and the whole town is there again, and the notable names and faces that we all know.
And that library, that building, and we're fortunate that that building still stands today. That building has always been a fixture in my life growing up here in Grand Island.
Talk about it.
Well, I went to St. Mary's Catholic Grade School, and my siblings and I, at the end of each day, we would walk from the school, which was only a couple blocks away. We always went past the Grand Island Independent Building so we could watch the presses run, because it was an evening paper at the time. So we were getting there just as the presses were running. But then we spent, from the time period after school until my dad came and picked us up after he got done with work about five, a little bit after five, we spent that time every day after school in the library.
Wow.
And it was probably one of the most wonderful things. Did it impress me on reading? I mean, I'm a voracious reader as it is. You know, I read tons of the books. I would check out all kinds of books all the time in there. There, at that time, we're talking the 1960s, there is the Carnegie Building, and that had more of the adult books. And then the children's library was actually the little tiny building just to the east of it. And so early on, it was time spent in there with all of the children's books. And I have a lot of books that I read there at that time. But then as I got older and needed to do research and everything, I spent time in the other library, and a lot of arts and crafts, heavy oak furniture and books. And there's just something about the smell of a library that is so heartwarming.
Yeah,
I am so glad that I had that experience. Probably not an experience you could do today, but it was something that during that time, my siblings and I had the opportunity to spend every day, more or less, in the library.
And for free.
Yes, know, for free.
It's one of those unique, great institutions that we just got right as a not as a country, but as a people, that, you know,
There
are spaces for people to be educated.
There's just something right, about being able to go into a library, pick a book up off the shelf, sit down in a chair, and just start consuming that book.
Yeah.
It's just, I can't express just how important that was to me growing up.
Yeah, and I mean, you weren't the only one. as you mentioned, you know, the Carnegie Library existed on its own for several decades, and you were a part of that, you know, tradition, and you attended that library and have very fond memories of it. But as you said, you kind of advanced into the Edith Abbott public library here in Grand Island
That was a little bit different. And that, I don't have a lot of, I remember when it was being built, but I can't remember the specific time periods. I was a little sad that we weren't going to be able to go into that nice old building anymore. It was probably what I was remembering more at that time.
Yeah, the library existed just in and of itself at the Carnegie location until 1974, when the library, which is not that big of a structure, you know, kind of grew to the point that it needed.
They outgrew the space that they had. I mean, they were already out of the Carnegie Building and into the little structure next door, and that was jam-packed full of just the kids section.
Yeah.
And with the advent of, you know, eventually technology changes, they needed more space.
Exactly, and they got it. And the Edith Abbott Memorial Library, is that
correct?
It is a very impressive place educationally for a town like Grand Island, in my opinion.
It was a way to really spread out the books and to have a space where people could do, they established some research rooms and some other type of special rooms. The Genealogical Society got a room there so that they could have their collection housed and accessible to people. There's a lot of things that happened because they were able to move to this new location.
Exactly. And the reason it's named for Edith Abbott is just, I think, because of her substantial contributions over the years to the betterment of the library in general.
It's connected to the Abbotts, Mrs. O.A. Abbott. It was a very important part of her life. And so it became an important part of the Abbott sisters' lives growing up as well. And Edith talked about this in a statement that she put out. Our local suffrage society was made up largely of women who wanted to help and whatever was for the good of the town. When the suffrage vote was lost, there was a balance of money in the society's treasury, which was large enough to really be useful to a small western town such as Grand Island. Mother was interested in reading and in making it possible for others to read. And she argued vigorously about the need for books for everyone. Mother thought that the women of the suffrage organization should show that they were public-spirited even when they were defeated and start a library. The new public library was, of course, a very small collection of books at first, and a young lawyer was paid to give part of his time to look after it. Shelves were put up on one side of his office, and we were all taken down to see the new books properly numbered and labeled there. Mother was very proud of it, and the public library was, for the rest of her life, one of her chief interests. She was a member of the library board continuously for 45 years and was for a long time president and then honorary president of the board. I am sure our small town public library, of which Mother was the moving spirit, has been a great source of lasting benefit and pleasure to the large number of families, as it was to all of us. Grace and I made almost daily visits to the library during the summer, and how we enjoyed getting away from some of the things we knew we ought to be done at home. Grace used to say, "We're just like Mother. We'd rather read than sweep." And I guess we're all right about it. There was a kind of serenity about a library which was inviting, and there were so many of the books that we could not afford to buy, Miss Alcott's stories and Mark Twain's. A large part of our education came from what was a very small public library. Mother worked hard over the lists of books to be purchased, and there were certainly carefully selected volumes and not just stories to amuse people, as Mother would say.
That's beautiful.
I about teared up reading this because it's like it hit home to me.
I know you just said that was kind of the same way that you spent your childhood.
A connection.
Yeah, that's great. And that's awesome. And the official board minutes, it ultimately said when they were crafting this library that Edith Abbott had donated essentially her life savings to the creation of this institution. And given everything you just said and how her mother mm-hmm. donated 40 years of her life to being on the board and all of that kind of, you know, well-deserved.
Yeah, it was very, very important part of her, you know, her growing up, just as it has been probably for literally thousands of kids here in Grand Island.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to kind of shift gears. And when we come back, we are going to be speaking with a librarian from the Edith Abbott Memorial Library here in Grand Island. So stick with us, and we will be back after these words.
Today's broadcast is brought to you by General Mercantile Emporium, offering general lines of parasols, pickles, gloves, books, and candy. The finest goods are always available at the General Mercantile Emporium, Front Street, Railroad Town, Nebraska.
And welcome back to more of the Stuart Crazy Podcast. I'm joined today by Sean Klee of the Grand Island Public Library, who is the Adult and Technical Services Librarian of that institution. thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Sean, I wanted to just kind of ask you a little bit more about your profession to start this podcast off. Earlier, we talked about the history of libraries. How did you first get interested in the profession of librarian, and how long have you been working in this field?
Well, kind of like most librarians, I've always enjoyed books and reading, but it's a little bit of a funny story. My first library job was in college as an undergrad. I worked part-time on campus at the music library, and I absolutely disliked working at the music library. I didn't like it at all. So I kind of thought, oh, well, maybe libraries aren't for me. So I went on to working other things. I was a resident assistant and worked for housing the rest of my undergrad college career. And my bachelor's degree is in anthropology, so I was thinking about going into grad school for anthropology. And while I was deciding, I had taken some odd jobs around town, and a circulation clerk position came up at the public library in Grand Forks. I went to the University of North Dakota.
Okay.
So I applied, and I got the job there, and I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed working there.
What was the change, you think?
I think just a change in the subject matter, patrons, having programs. You know, music library was very narrowly focused. It was sound recordings and musical manuscripts and books related just to things music majors would use. So it was a little library that didn't get used very much, but everybody came to the public library, kids, teens, adults, senior citizens, everyone in town. And I just enjoyed it. So I kind of changed focus and went to graduate school for library science instead. So I went to the University of Oklahoma for library and information studies. And there I worked at the Pioneer Library System in Norman. I was a reference assistant at the reference desk there. And after school, my first professional job was in Beatrice at the Beatrice Public Library. And shortly after that, the position that I'm in now came open here in Grand Island, and I've been here ever since. So that's been just about 5 years that I've worked professionally as a librarian in libraries.
Wow. You're definitely dedicated to the craft, yeah. And we appreciate your public service, that's for sure.
Thank you.
I know it's definitely not easy to traverse that sort of those sorts of changes as a fellow, you know, academically minded person. You kind of have to go where the jobs are in your field.
Definitely.
There's not too many library sciences graduate programs, are there? Did you have trouble finding one that really suited your interests?
Yeah, at the time there was about 40 or 42, I think, accredited by the American Library Association. So that did help. It did narrow down possibilities quite a bit when there's fewer than 50.
Sure.
So I kind of just looked at ones that were kind of close by. Of course, there aren't really any in the upper Great Plains. There's one in accredited school in Minneapolis, and there's an online one in Kansas. And other than that, they're just kind of around. I know there's one in Missouri and Oklahoma, of course, but so I just kind of looked regionally and
and the way that libraries are portrayed in popular media I'm sure is much different than the actual study and dedication that it takes. Have you ever come across a person in popular culture that either got it right or completely wrong?
Yes, I guess yes and no. It's a little bit of truth in everything, I guess, but libraries are not the quiet place where you have the one elderly lady behind the desk that shushes everybody. They're a community center. They're loud. There's things for everyone there. So,
yeah. Speaking of those opportunities at the Grand Island Public Library, I know that there's far more, you know, than just checking out library books. It's kind of become, as you said, sort of a community center. Sure. What are some of those opportunities that exist for people in this community at the library?
We do a lot of programming. We have the summer reading program every year to encourage literacy for all ages. We have other sorts of programming, like programs geared for homeschoolers. We have a lot of historical related programs. Like we just had Jeff Barr was there discussing historical markers around the state of Nebraska. There's family history research opportunities there. We have our maker space that has a lot of cool equipment in it, like 3D printer, sublimation printer, laser cutter and engraver.
Yeah.
There's computers, internet access, printing, and more than just books. We have tons of DVDs to check out and audiobooks, and we have our online collections of databases and digital materials like ebooks and audiobooks, and you can even borrow TV shows and movies on your phone from our Hoopla app and
sure.
watch a movie on your phone.
Cool. And so you said at the beginning that, or I said, I guess, that you are the adult and technical services sure. librarian. Could you kind of maybe enunciate that a little sure. bit for, more for us? And how many different sorts of librarian are there at the Grand Island Public Library?
Well, at the library, our library, there are only three librarians with library science degrees. The library director, Celine, the children's and family services librarian, Laura, and myself. So in my position, adult services handles like adult programming, the adult summer reading program. I oversee the reference desk and circulation desks and manage the collections for adults. So I'm ordering materials, deselecting materials when it's time to withdraw things from the collection, all of that. Yeah. And then technical services is kind of all the behind the scenes work of the library, cataloging, ordering, processing materials, all of the kind of behind the scenes things that most people don't really know about or don't understand what sure. happens at the library.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you with regard mm-hmm. to the like kind of the research component, mm-hmm. I know Stern Museum gets a ton of research sure. requests as well, but I know the library does as well, and we yes. kind of work in tandem to yeah. get people the best results that sure. they can. What sorts of archival materials does the Grand Island Public Library hold?
Well, the I would say the thing we get asked about most frequently is the Independent. We have the entire run of the Independent on microfilm from the 1880s all the way up to the most recent shipment we've received on microfilm within the past few months. And we also have Newsbank, which does have the more recent editions of the Independent on it. So if it was preserved, we have it for the past 120 some years of the Independent. I know there are some very few issues that are missing, but
sure.
we have almost the entire print run of that. That's the most popular thing we get asked for. We have a lot of family history related materials, local history items as well. We house our own local history collection and our own small genealogy collection. We also have the Sprague genealogy collection. She was a well-known person in the community who is a big genealogist who donated all of her materials that she amassed over her lifetime to the library, which has things mainly to do with the East Coast of New England, since that was where her family was from.
Okay.
And then we also house the Lou R. Spencer Daughters of the American Revolution library collection. They have church histories and genealogies and family histories and vital records and research guides and help books for all over the country in their collection.
And is that a pretty common request, people stopping in for, you know, their own personal research into those different archival sources?
Mostly the family history and genealogy is the biggest draw, especially obituary requests out of the newspaper.
Okay. What does the future of libraries look like, do you think, in the coming years? Are there big changes coming your way, especially with like the generational changes that have been happening lately?
Sure. So there's a big, it's a big trend in libraries. I don't know if you'd call it trend or movement. It's called having the Library of Things, where it's not just books at the library. Like we've mentioned, we have movies to check out. We have movie kits. We have makerspace equipment. We have storytime kits that have toys and other educational items to go along with the books that you can check out. So moving away from just having the print tomes to having something for everyone and having technology and places for people to meet and, yeah, just having it be kind of a community center.
Sure. And I'm sure, like, what your role in this process has got to be a very fulfilling experience. It's mm-hmm. what you chose to go
yeah.
into. And I'm wondering, you know, is this a possible career that people can go into and find a job fairly easily? Or is it a pretty difficult task to find a job as a career librarian?
Professional jobs, if someone is really interested, I will say you do need to be willing to move somewhere. You may not be able to find a job in your location. So if you really do want to go into that, you'll have to be willing to move probably. But other than professional jobs, there's library technicians, library clerk, pages. You can volunteer at libraries. We have a lot of volunteers. There's a lot of different sorts of opportunities for being at the library other than being just a librarian.
And I guess if you had to give advice to someone who was starting out in this career path, educationally or otherwise, as somebody who's kind of worked in the industry, gone through school for over 5 years now, what would you advise to them?
I guess it depends on what your area of the library is you're interested in. Like, for example, if you are interested in children's, being in the children's library, make sure you have experience with children's, elementary education, or volunteer to daycare or summer camp or something like that. Or if you're interested in adult type things, demonstrate that you can do research, or that you like to read and have a wide knowledge of authors or films or something that you'll be asked for help with.
Sure.
So, yeah.
And it is a professional program at the graduate level, I know, but does that mean that someone has to have a degree in library sciences often to be a librarian at this point, or is it something that you can maybe learn and graduate into?
It depends on, I guess, the library you work at and how they have their organization structured. Yes and no. There's a lot that I learned on the job, even though I had gone and gotten a library degree. But for some librarian positions, that is the requirement for the job, is to have the master's degree. So it really depends on what your focus is. And
yeah. Sean, I'll ask you one more thing. Do you have anything coming up at the library in the coming days, weeks, months that you're excited about and wanting to share with us?
Sure. We have our second Bygone Book Club coming up, and our second Heritage Hour event coming up in the middle of October. The Bygone Book Club is our book club that discusses historical books that have to do with Central Nebraska and Nebraska history. And the one coming up is all about the legal justice system in the time of Buffalo Bill in Nebraska. That one is more out towards North Platte, but
very cool.
That'll be interesting. And we have a retired judge that'll come and be the moderator for that. And then Heritage Hour is a partnership program we have with various groups around the community, the library, PPGS, Prairie Pioneer Genealogy, and the DAR, and other groups that will talk about all sorts of different family history things you can do with the library and with the groups. The upcoming one is all about using our new Family Search affiliate status at the library to use previously restricted records that you could only access at Family Search sites. Oh, wow. So,
okay. Sean, I won't take up any more of your time. Okay. I really appreciate you stopping by the podcast.
Sure. No problem.
Thanks very much. Mm-hmm. We are going to be back with more of the Sewer Crazy podcast right after these words. Stick around. This is going to conclude another episode and another season of the Stuart Crazy podcast. We just want to thank you so much for joining us on this journey. We've done a lot of episodes, a lot of fun historical content, and we hope there is so much more to come. We're going to be taking a break now for the next few weeks, but when we come back, we are going to be joining you again with more historic content, more stories to tell, and more local history to unpack. So thank you very much, and we will be back in a few weeks.